Well, good evening, and welcome to the third presentation in this, our 15th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate the series with help from our webmaster taking pictures, Haiwong Wan, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Dustin Johnson designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadon Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of Kentucky, where her maternal family has lived since 1792. Growing up on a small farm outside Louisville, she wanted to be an archaeologist. She read constantly from an early age and believes that her love of books influenced her life. She attended schools in Louisville before enrolling at the University of Louisville, where her passion was ancient history and the history of the English Reformation. After a BA in history, she received her JD from the Chase College of Law and was in private practice in Northern Kentucky for a year before beginning work for the state in 1995. Her legal concentration is in workers' compensation, administrative regulations, contracts, and ethics. Her family lived in Shelby County for many years, so moving there in 2004 was like coming home. She first learned of the Taylor Denhart case from an article published in Shelby Life, a local magazine. And in 2009, after former State Representative Steve Nunn of Glasgow shot and killed Amanda Ross in a downtown parking lot, it revived her interest in the earlier case. For the past 7 years, she's been researching one of Kentucky's most intriguing criminal cases, the death of Verna Gar Taylor on the night of November 6, 1936. Her new book, Dark Highway, is the result, and she mined transcripts of the two trials associated with the case, read newspaper articles about them, examined files from the Filson Society in Louisville, and looked at legal records of some of the lawyers. She also interviewed relatives of people mentioned in the book and even walked along the highway 146 in Henry County, where Taylor's body was found. When not working or researching cold cases, she enjoys spending time with her daughters, gardening, and pet therapy. Please welcome Ann D'Angelo. Ann?
Thank you very much, Brian. I've actually walked the dark highway in Henry County many times. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, and I'd like to thank the Western Kentucky University Libraries Kentucky Live Speaker Series for inviting me to come tonight. I say it's always good to be back in Bowling Green. It's not every day that you become so fascinated with a topic that you just have to write a book about it. But that's what happened to me. And people who read the book are also becoming caught up in it. They're going out and finding the locations in Oldham, Henry, and Shelby counties. And Shelbyville just did a two-night reenactment of the Gar brothers' trial. It drew large and enthusiastic crowds, which just amazed me. Tonight, I'm going to give you a brief overview of the story. If I told you everything I knew, we'd be here a long time. And I'm also going to share some of my experiences with you in writing the book. I will be very happy to take your questions afterward. As Brian said, I had never heard the intriguing story of Verna Gar Taylor and Henry Denhart until I picked up a local magazine called Shelby County Life in 2007. The article commemorated the 70th anniversary of the death of General Denhart in a hail of bullets on Main Street in Shelbyville in front of the old Armstrong Hotel. Today, there's a bronze historic marker near the corner of 6th and Main that marks the place where the hotel used to stand before it burned in 1944. If you look closely at the sign, it notes that Brigadier General Henry H. Dinhart was slain at this spot on September 20th, 1937. So, how in the world did a Brigadier General and a former Lieutenant Governor of the state end up shot to death in the doorway of a hotel in Shelbyville, Kentucky? Well, this tale is a wild ride from 1936 and 37. And the death of General Dinhart's fiancée, Vernagar Taylor, is one of the most baffling and enduring mysteries in Kentucky history. The hotbeds of this tragedy have always been Shelby and Oldham and Henry counties. But this is also very much a Bowling Green story, because Bowling Green was General Dinhart's hometown. It's also the home of Rhodes Myers, his attorney who nearly lost his life in Shelbyville on the night that Dinhart died. Now, in 2007, I read the magazine article in Shelby County Life, and I found the story amazing. And I also wondered how in the world I had never heard of it before, because I am a native Kentuckian. On the night of November 6, 1936, the body of Vernagar Taylor, General Dinhart's fiancée, was found in a ditch 6 miles outside of LaGrange in Henry County. She'd been shot through the heart. The general was present at the scene, and his service revolver was near her feet. He immediately claimed it was a suicide. There was a sensational trial to determine his guilt or innocence, but the story didn't end with the trial. It only became more sensational. Now, at the time, I had no desire to research or dig into it any further. I just thought it was a fascinating story. Fast forward 2 years, and we had another state politician go off the rails. Steve Nunn was accused of shooting his ex-fiancée, Amanda Ross, and I can only guess that that situation brought back the 1936 story to my mind. It hit me like a lightning bolt, and I simply had to find out more. I didn't set out to write a book. I've become a believer that sometimes a writer chooses the topic they're going to write a book about, but sometimes mysteriously the topic chooses the writer. And I guess that's what happened to me. I started researching in January 2010, and I really couldn't stop. It pulled me in like quicksand. I was totally hooked. After 6 months, a distant relative of Verna's suggested I start putting my notes into some sort of a format and think of writing a book. So I did. For the next 6 years, I followed a scattered trail of trial transcripts. Over dinner tonight, I described it as being like an Easter egg hunt. Things were everywhere. Trial transcripts, court files, letters between the parties, military records, a plethora of newspaper and magazine articles, including detective magazines. Remember the old detective magazines? They really loved this case. Over time, those notes became chapters, and the chapters evolved into the 3 sections of the book. I also interviewed people who were very elderly, who remembered events, or they remembered some of the characters in the book. And I interviewed family members, Dinhart family members, as well as members of the Gar and Taylor families. And along the way, I learned a lesson in how a violent crime can affect a family dynamic for generations, long after the person who died violently, long after they can even remember anyone who knew them. Perhaps because of this, I always felt an obligation to stick to the facts and the evidence and not to sensationalize. Too much of that had already been done to the families. When I was writing, I felt a great deal of compassion for both sides in this saga. This is a tragic story where both families lost people they loved and were left to survive the constant barrage of overblown news coverage. One interesting facet of this story is that both the victim and the alleged murderer were from very, very good families, well known and well respected in their communities. Now, for 6 years, I worked as an attorney during the day, I still do, and I would come home in the evening, get my daughter to bed around 10 o'clock, and start writing. I would write until the wee hours. I like to say that a lot of Dark Highway was written around the witching hour. Luckily, I prefer to write at night. I have friends who get up at 4 or 5 in the morning and start writing, and the thought of that is just painful to me. Most weekends were spent either writing or researching. And I was very lucky living in Shelby County. I was close to Newcastle and close to LaGrange. Some writers will lay their work aside for a week or a month and wait for inspiration to come back to it. I was always inspired. I never had to lay it down. I simply couldn't. It would haunt me if I laid it down. A laptop even followed me along on vacations, and I can look at chapters and say, oh, I was in Miami when I wrote that, or I was in the mountains when I wrote that. In 2010, I started with a blank slate, and I made no assumptions. I'm not related to anyone in Dark Highway, so I had no agenda. My goal from the beginning was to do the story justice. I never assumed that General Denhart was the murderer, and I never assumed that Vernagar Taylor didn't commit suicide. I let the evidence lead me to the conclusions I was able to reach, and Dark Highway was published in July 2016. Now, just a couple of days after the book was released, I spoke at a writer's conference in Louisville. They asked me to come and speak about writing true crime. Well, I'll be honest with you, to me it wasn't true crime, it was Kentucky history. But that is the genre of this book. Now, the first question I asked the group was, how many of you all have ever heard the name Brigadier General Henry H. Denhart? Raise your hands. Well, they all just looked at me blank. And I did not even bother to ask about Vernagar Taylor. My hope is that a year later, many more people know who they were, and they know more about Denhart's role in Kentucky history. If you had been living in the 20s and the 30s, you would immediately recognize his name as a heavy hitter in state Democratic politics. Denhart was born here in Bowling Green in 1876 to William and Margaret Denhart. He was the youngest of 5 children. His older siblings were William, Jesse, Minnie, and Bertha. The Denharts were industrious, hardworking German immigrants. The elder William had fought for the Union in the Civil War. He enlisted at age 18. The two oldest sons, William and Jesse, eventually owned and operated the Bowling Green Times Journal. And for a while, Henry was also involved in that enterprise, but he wanted to be a lawyer, so he went back to law school. During his lifetime, Henry Denhart would hold a number of distinguished titles and positions. He was an attorney. He was a Warren County judge. His judicial portrait is in the old courthouse, by the way, and if you get a chance to stop by there and take a look, his portrait's a little bit different than the other judges. Denhart's in his army uniform, and he looks like he's barking an order, and when you look at him, you would immediately want to say, yes, sir. He was a decorated World War I hero, lieutenant governor during the 20s, and he was actually a two-time candidate for governor himself. He was a state-appointed adjutant general, and he was a brigadier general in the Kentucky National Guard. The Denhart Armory downtown was named for him. His legacy was fairly set until the night of November 6, 1936, when he took on the not-so-distinguished title for which he would always be remembered, if he's even remembered at all, alleged murderer. Denhart's last official position with state government was adjutant general. And when A.B. Happy Chandler was elected, Denhart knew he was finished. The two men had been at political odds in the past. So in January 1936, he packed up his office in Frankfort, and he moved to Oldham County. Now, in the past, he had always come back to Bowling Green. But in 1935, he bought an 800-acre farm at an estate auction. And there was quite a large house on the back of it. This house was built around 1803. Now, this picture was taken, it's an Associated Press or Wire photo picture. It was taken right about the time of Vernagar Taylor's death. There were reporters swarming all over his property. Take a look at this tree in the foreground, and I'll show you what the property looks like today. A lot of it is gone. It's shored up inside by boards. Of course, the tree has gotten a lot of growth over the years. And I was able to go inside, and I even went upstairs. Denhart moved to this house with his sister Bertha in January 36. Bertha served as his housekeeper, and she took care of her younger brother. She was his biggest supporter, and she always believed in him, even when others didn't. I like to say that if he had moved back to Warren County, I wouldn't be standing here with a book. But within 6 months, he met Vernagar Taylor, and the die was cast. Vernagar Taylor was not just an attractive woman, she was an intelligent an astute businesswoman. I'd also characterize her as strong and resilient. Her husband died in 1931, leaving her the family business, the community laundry of LaGrange, at the worst possible time in U.S. economic history. And for the next 5 years, she worked tirelessly to make the business a success and to keep her employees working. And she did. I think it's a testament to her that on the night she died, she had $3,500 in the bank and no debts. I'm hoping that some of her will rub off on me from writing her story. She was the sole support of her household, and she had two teenage daughters and was very active in the LaGrange Methodist Church, where she served on a number of committees, and she was a Sunday school teacher. In short, she was one of the most respectable people, male or female, in town. Now, these two met in early June 1936. Denhart was an aging 60. In his photographs, I always think he looks about 5 years older than his stated age. Verna, on the other hand, was a vivacious 40. The relationship that innocently developed from dinners, movies, and drives in the countryside is the very definition of an ill-fated romance. The Oldham Era, in one of its many articles about the murder case, once referred to it as a bloodstained romance. I really wouldn't argue with that at all. Within 14 months of that initial meeting, both were dead, violently. One out on what is now Highway 146 in Henry County, and the other right smack in the middle of downtown Shelbyville. According to Denhart, the two became engaged on August 30th, and he presented her with a beautiful diamond ring. Now, after 7 years of searching, I finally found the ring this year. And here's another picture of it. It's on my hand. It's beside this ring. It didn't want to leave my hand, but I had to give it back. I really don't think I've ever seen another ring to equal it. And I came away with the thought that whatever happened out on the dark highway on November 6th, on August 30th, he must have been crazy about her. Theirs was a whirlwind romance and a short engagement from August 30th until her death in early November. Dark Highway begins with that fateful night of November 6th, when a telephone call comes into the funeral home in LaGrange. Now, funeral director Smith Kightley was on duty, and he remembered the time as 10 o'clock. He said, "My favorite radio show comes on at 10 o'clock, and I had just sat down in my chair to listen to it when the phone rang." Now, what struck me most in writing this scene was how the course of our lives can be changed so completely by something as innocuous as the ringing of a telephone. Kightley undoubtedly thought that this was an ordinary death call, but this particular call from local barber J.B. Hunley was about to change his life and the lives of many other people forever. Hunley said he had been sent to fetch Kightley out to George and Nettie Baker's farm, where he said a woman was dead from a gunshot wound and lying in a ditch or old roadbed just beyond their property line. Hunley knew who it was. He said, "It's Vernegar Taylor." With all the horrible things we hear daily, it's hard to convey just how stunned and appalled people were by the violent death of one of Oldham County's most respectable women. It's hard to describe just how big an event this was, but I can tell you that people in their 90s could tell me exactly where they were when they heard the news of her death. I had one lady tell me that she had been to a Bible contest in Lawrenceburg the night before, and when her car pulled up the next morning in the driveway, her mother came running out of the house to come and tell her that Verna had died. Another lady told me her mother woke her up in the middle of the night. If friends and acquaintances were shocked, it's hard to imagine the profound effect this would have had on Verna's two teenage daughters. Now, when Kightley arrived at the scene, General Denhart was there, and he immediately claimed that Verna had committed suicide. He told a strange story. He said that the two had been on a day trip to Louisville, and throughout the day, Verna became increasingly depressed and despondent. And that evening, they were on their way home. She was driving and drove on through LaGrange into Henry County, and when she went to turn the car around, it was his car, it stalled with a dead battery. Local farmer George Baker and J.B. Hunley helped push the car to Baker's driveway, and Hunley sped off to LaGrange to get a battery and a mechanic. While he was gone, Denhart said he walked to the side door of the Baker house to ask about a telephone, and when he came back, Verna was gone. And then he heard a loud shot from up the road. He immediately claimed it was a suicide, but the authorities thought otherwise. This story grew legs very, very quickly. Verna died on Friday night, and it made its first appearance in the New York Times on Sunday. The small town tale had all the scandalous and lurid elements to capture the attention of the 1930s reading public. The brutal death of a beautiful woman, a powerful politician suspected of murder, and a sensational murder trial to determine his guilt or innocence. Over the next year, the story was carried in newspapers around the nation and even internationally. I found an article in an Australian newspaper, and the London Herald carried stories. There were articles and pictures in Life, Newsweek, and Time magazines. Last summer, like so many other people, I was watching the Amelia Earhart special. And at one point, they showed the front page of a newspaper called The Evening Sun. And on one side, there was an article about Amelia Earhart. And on the other side, there was an article about the Denhart case. I nearly fell off the couch. Verna was buried on Sunday. And 5 days later, she was exhumed at night for an autopsy. What a scene that was in the cemetery. Two local physicians concluded that she died from one shot through the heart and that it was not a suicide. The trajectory of the shot was a little odd. It would have been traveling from the left breast to the right side, below her shoulder, 2 inches higher in the exit wound than it was in the entry wound. She would have been in a cramped position like this to have shot herself with what was a very large gun. This is a picture of the gun. This is a Smith & Wesson 45 caliber U.S. Army model 1917, and I can assure you that no parts of it are plastic. It is in the hands of a woman who is the very same size as Vernagar Taylor. I nearly drove my friends crazy with this. But this woman is 5'8", 145 pounds. Verna was tall and slender, with an arm length of 26 inches from shoulder to the tip of the finger tips. Thanks to the Kentucky Military History Museum and the Kentucky Historical Society, I was able to handle this gun, and also we were able to shoot pictures of it. I had the make and model from the trial transcript. I can tell you that when I put it in the model's hands, they gave just a little bit, and her first words were, "There's no way." I'd guess that gun weighed maybe 2.5-3 pounds. I wish I'd had a scale with me. It was very, very heavy. And the defense would have you to believe that Verna shot this gun one-handed. When her body was found, she had a glove clutched in her left hand. The general was indicted for murder by the Henry County Grand Jury in January 1937. And he was going to be tried in January 1937. We were talking about speedy justice, something we are not so familiar with today. But if January 1937 sounds just a little bit ominous to you history buffs out there, it should. That was the beginning of the Great Flood. It delayed the start of Denhart's murder trial until April. The trial began on April the 19th, and it was quite a spectacle. On the courthouse lawn, there were musicians singing, booths selling sandwiches and drinks, and there was even a snake charmer performing for the crowd's amusement. I've been to a number of legal events during my career, and I have never seen a snake charmer perform. It's fair to say, though, that Denhart had been tried and convicted in the press and in public opinion before he ever took a seat at the defense table. As might be expected, he had some outstanding lawyers on his team. They were John Barry. This is John Barry, father of Wendell, by the way. Here's Rhodes Myers. And this fellow was Clark Oddie, a crack defense attorney from Louisville. Rhodes Myers, of course, was a renowned orator. And Barry was a very solid, excellent lawyer who was familiar with Henry County Circuit Court practice and Judge Charles Marshall, who would hear the case. And of course, you know who this fella is over here. This is Henry Denhart. Newspapers estimated that there were between 1,200 and 1,500 people in the courtroom daily. There were people sitting on the radiators. They were sitting in the windowsills. They were propped up against the walls, or they were simply standing. Those who could not sit simply stood to watch the trial, and it was quite a press of humanity. If there had been an emergency, I can't imagine what would have happened. If you had a seat and you didn't want to lose it at lunch recess, you lowered a rope to the courthouse lawn below and you hauled up your lunch. The Dinhart murder trial was unlike anything seen in Kentucky up to that time. There was national and international coverage. There were out-of-state experts in ballistics, chemistry, pathology, blood splatter, blood typing. Today we are very familiar with the practice of using expert witnesses, dueling experts, with national reputations. But in 1937, this was new territory. There was even a modern marvel introduced at the trial called the sparkograph machine, capable of photographing the gases released when a bullet left the barrel. And this was important because to have a positive paraffin test of your hands, there had to be gases that came from the gun. The Dinhart trial was also an excellent example of trial as public entertainment, something else we've become familiar with today. And it was a good example of the primitive state of forensics in Kentucky in 1937. At one point, a hog's carcass was rolled into court for a ballistics demonstration. Pieces of the victim's skin cut from around her wounds were entered as exhibits in a jar of preservative solution. It was a rough, rough trial. And this spectacle lasted for 2 weeks. And the jury came back in on May 5th with a very surprising result. They could not determine Dinhart's guilt or innocence. Now this was shocking, because on April the 19th, the only questions were how much time he was going to get, or whether he was going to get the electric chair. Rumors immediately spread that the jury had been bribed. And I still run into people in Oldham and Henry counties that come up and say, you know that jury was bribed. And I say, give me some names, give me some examples, tell me, and I'll go look. No one can ever give you a name. It was just one of those things that circulated. Ultimately, I think what happened here was that the evidence was simply too complex for a jury pool with very little education. I've read that trial transcript a number of times, and I can tell you that the expert witnesses are quite often hard to follow, even if you have much more education than the jury. I'm sure they wondered how in the world a chemical solution or a multi-base nitrocellulose nitroglycerin gunpowder related to whether Dinhart pulled the trigger or Verna pulled the trigger. Worst of all, no one had a believable explanation for how she died out on the highway that night. But Prosecutor H.B. Kinsolving was not to be outdone. He was determined to get a conviction for the family, and a second trial date was set for September. And the general went home for the summer, this time back home to Bowling Green. It was no longer safe for him to stay on his Oldham County farm. He was out on bail, thanks to his good friend, Dr. Arthur McCormick. Now, Dinhart spent weeks quibbling with his attorneys over how much he was willing to pay. Believe it or not, they had not been paid when they went into court with him. A check had no sooner been issued by him in early July than another front opened. This time, he was accused of murdering a woman named Patricia Wilson at the Sealback Hotel in Louisville, in July 1936. In a civil wrongful death suit, Dinhart was accused of assaulting and beating Wilson, causing her to fall to her death in an elevator shaft of the hotel. Now, what I find interesting is that criminal charges were never brought against the general. This was a civil suit for monetary damages by the family. Generally, the civil suit arises out of the criminal case. I'm sure that's not always the case. It wasn't here, but most often it does. The classic example is the O.J. Simpson case, where he was acquitted, and then the family sued for monetary damages. I don't believe a thorough investigation of Ms. Wilson's death was ever done when her body was found. The newspapers dismissed her as a party girl, which was a polite 1930s term for a prostitute. She was one of the women who gathered at the Sealback, attracted to the wealthy and powerful men who used the hotel as their watering hole. And Denhard admittedly was one of these men. But I believe if there had been real evidence of his guilt, there would have been criminal charges. Now, unfortunately, we don't find out anything more about what their possible relationship might have been or what might have happened, because this case was still in the legal system as Denhard's September trial date approached. Now, throughout the summer, he had insisted to anyone who would listen that he would not be tried again. As late as mid-August on maneuvers at Fort Knox, the New York Times caught up with him and he told a reporter, "I don't think they'll hold another trial in September. They don't have enough evidence. I didn't do it," he added for good measure. I found no evidence in my research that the general was psychic, but he was spot on when he said he wouldn't be tried again. On September the 20th, he left Bowling Green for the last time in the company of his attorney, Rhodes Myers. And the two men traveled to Shelbyville, where they checked into the Armstrong Hotel. Now, Louisville would have been the safer and less obvious place to stay, but they were due in court pretty early the next morning over in Newcastle. Shelbyville was closer. They also thought they were safely outside the hotbeds of Oldham and Henry counties. That was a fateful decision. That evening, Denhard came face to face with Verna's brothers at the corner of 6th and Main, and he died in a desperate, zigzagging military run to reach the doorway of the hotel. Approximately 7 wild shots were fired, and 3 of them struck the general, all from the back. He was hit twice in the back, once in the back of the head. He didn't have a gun on him. Here are the brothers. On the left is Jack, the youngest brother. I've always thought he kind of looks like Errol Flynn. He was the nicest looking of them. The middle brother is Doc, so-called because he was a veterinarian. The newspapers referred to him as the frail veterinarian. He suffered from PTSD. The brother on the right is the middle brother, Roy. Now, only Roy and Doc shot that night. Jack was not armed. There's a song that was popular in late 1937 that begins like this. "The harvest moon was shining on the streets of Shelbyville on the night that General Denhard met his fate. The Gar boys was a-waiting, they was out to shoot to kill. Death and General Denhard had a date." By the way, the chorus of that goes, "Oh, sad the fate of Soldier Henry, his military record clean. He lies beneath the sod, and his soul is flown to God, and he's buried in Bowling Green." The question has always been out there whether this was intentionally done by the brothers. And that was the question that I faced in writing part 3 of Dark Highway. Now, folklore says it was intentional, but in writing the book, distinguishing what was fact from fiction was often a challenge. In my research, I found nothing but hearsay that pointed to a conspiracy on their part. My family always said, great-grandmother always said, or simply, well, of course you know they did. The brothers were convincing under oath, and their stories all lined up exactly. I've had a family member tell me, Doc's grandson, who looks like him except he doesn't have the mustache, that it would be far out of character for these men to have done it intentionally. And from what I know of them in my research, I would tend to agree. My position in writing this part of Dark Highway is that without definite proof otherwise, that isn't just hearsay, it would be wrong 80 years later to disturb sworn testimony and say they perjured themselves. The sympathy of the press and public had always been with Verna's family, and it didn't change even after Denhart was murdered. Baskets of food began to arrive at the jail for the Garr brothers. There were letters and telegrams of support from all over the country. They had suddenly become celebrities and heroes. The overwhelming feeling of people at the time was that Denhart simply got what he deserved. I spoke with a very elderly member of the Denhart family back in 2012. She actually remembered the general. And I will never forget what she said to me. She said, I don't know about his guilt or innocence, but I always thought it was a shame the way he died. I would agree with that. It was a disgraceful end for somebody who had once led a distinguished, sometimes controversial, but a distinguished life. The Shelbyville trial of the Garr brothers was just as overblown and sensational as the one in Newcastle. Movie producer D.W. Griffith, Birth of a Nation, popular then but not so popular now, even showed up for the trial. Griffith owned a house on Verna Street in LaGrange. Now, what I found most interesting about the Shelbyville trial is that the victim and his character were on trial. To me, I thought it was the trial he should have received in Newcastle. Denhart was described by witness after witness as threatening, violent, power drunk, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He always carried a gun. It didn't seem to matter at all that he didn't have a gun on him the night he died. The trial of the Garr brothers is an example of jury nullification. From the beginning, there was nothing that could be said or done to change the minds of the jury. I don't know if you all have ever heard of a Courier Journal reporter named John Hershenroeder. He was around back in the 80s still, but he had covered the Denhart case. And he made the comment that a platoon of Marines could not have forced that jury to convict Roy Garr. Roy pled self-defense, and he was acquitted. The case against Jack was dismissed because, of course, he didn't have a weapon on him. Doc was able to appear at the preliminary or the examining trial, but by the time of the murder trial, he was under a doctor's case for mental issues. Doc suffered from quite a bad case of PTSD, or what the newspapers referred to as a nervous condition, or shell shock. His case was dismissed in February of 38. The prosecutor wisely said, if I can't convict Roy, there's no way that I can convict Doc. And things settled down. People became more concerned with the war drums from Europe. But then in late 1938, the case flashed into the headlines one more time when Doc gave an interview to the Louisville Times. And in that interview, he claimed that Denhart was involved in Verna's death, but that he didn't kill her. He said that there was at least one accomplice out on the highway that night, and he actually wrote a letter to Frankfurt urging the Attorney General to reopen the case, but it was easy to refuse Doc, and of course he was refused. A month and 18 days later, unfortunately, he was dead from peritonitis after surgery from an ulcerated stomach. The conspiracy theory of Verna's death, died and was buried with Doc in Cave Hill Cemetery in Louisville until 2016. As the years of research passed, I had become convinced that I was researching a cold case, and no one had ever presented a solid theory of how Verna really died. I thought it would be interesting to exhume that theory and take a good look at it in Dark Highway. I like to think that Doc is glad that I did. Now I'm going to end tonight with the story of the book cover. I don't know, some of you all may be familiar with this, but there is a story behind the book cover. You know, writing a book is not always long hours and drudgery, and I've had some real adventures along the way. But one of the biggest adventures I had was on November 6th, 2015. I just happened to notice that the days in November 2015 lined up exactly with the days in 1936. So November 6, 2015 would come on a Friday. It would be 79 years to the day that Verna died. I happened to mention this to my editor, and she said, you know, you should get a photographer to go out there and take pictures. It would be an interesting thing for your website. She was always on me that I had to have a website. And I said, well, I do know a photographer, a good one. And she had a shop in Louisville, and she was willing to go out there with me. Her name is Vivian Knox Thompson, and she's been a photographer since the 80s. She's quite good. She asked me what I was looking for, and I said, eerie. Well, truer words were never spoken. She said, well, if you want that, we need to be there at dusk, shooting right about dusk. So we were out on the highway on November 6, 2015, and my car, I had pulled it into George Baker's driveway, right where Denhart's car would have been parked 79 years before. And it was my job to keep Vivian from getting hit by a car. It is a busier road out there than it was in 36. So she sat up in the road, set her camera tripod, and started shooting up the road in the direction that Verna would have walked that night from all angles. And there was no one else out there. There was no one out there but us and the car that passed by occasionally. Right about dark, we packed up the car and we left. When she loaded the photographs into her computer, I had asked her to darken out the overhead wires. There are overhead wires out there now, and there's a bank. Well, when she did, on two or three of the photographs, that figure showed up in the road. Now, what Vivian didn't know was that where that figure is walking in the road is right about the spot where Verna's body was found below in the ditch. I've never believed in spirit photographs because they're too easily manipulated. And you don't believe in things like that till it happens to you. But I like to say that the book has been a gift, and I certainly received one on November 6, 2015. Thank you all very much.
We have time for questions. Yes?
You mentioned that Rhodes Myers almost lost his life that night. Did he get shot also?
No. I should have gone into that a little farther. He was walking with Denhart, and when the brothers stepped out, he took off running one direction. Denhart took off running another direction. Doc went after Rose Myers, and he had a gun on him in the middle of the street. And it was Roy who came up and pushed Doc's arm down, saved his life.
Yes, back yes. here.
Why would they think it's reasonable for a very slim, like, I'm not saying that she was weak, but like she probably wasn't strong enough to hold a 44 in one hand and pull the trigger. How would they pull that off as a defense?
I don't know.
How would they think they got away with that?
You know, there were so many crazy theories that were out there. One had the prosecutor's theory had the general running 689 feet down the road. That's a long way. Shooting her, pulling her off the road into the ditch, and then running back down the down to the car. And he wasn't even out of breath when George Baker came out of the house. To me, that was just preposterous. And I think when the jury went out to the scene, they took the jury out there. That was one of the smartest things that the defense did, because they could look at this big, heavy guy who weighed upwards of 220 pounds and try to imagine him doing all these athletic things. He was not in good shape. Not at all. He was red-faced, very heavy. And like I say, he looked about 5 years older than his stated age. Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about these paraffin forensic tests and why they were not very conclusive?
Yes. Right away, after Verna died and was embalmed, they brought in a detective from Louisville to do paraffin tests on Verna and the general. Her paraffin test was done on Saturday. She had been embalmed and washed on Friday night. She was in her coffin at the house. Back then, they did visitations at the homes. The detective did the paraffin test on her hands after they'd been lightly washed. The general's paraffin test wasn't done until Monday afternoon. So I think today both of those tests would have been thrown out, but they entered them as evidence.
One of the intriguing, this story kept me up till 1 this morning, is the case of the general's raincoat, which had blood spattered on it. Can you talk a bit about this?
Yes. Now, what was interesting is when the investigators came to his house, they asked to see the coat he had on that night. Well, he goes and gets it, and he hands it to him. He has no problem. He doesn't hesitate a bit. And one of the investigators notices that there's little spots of blood on it. But Denhart wasn't aware of that, and he said, okay, and he handed it back. He left the house. And then he came back, he thought, I better take that coat with me. So he went back in, and he said, I'd like to take that coat with me. And Denhart made some kind of a comment, like, don't put any blood on this coat. There isn't any on it now. He said, let's walk out here in the yard in the light, and let's see what's on this coat. And there were specks of blood on the overcoat. Now, the question of the overcoat and the blood on the overcoat. The problem was that it didn't really look like blood spatter. It looked like pinpoints of blood, like somebody had a cut and did this, which is what his expert testified happened. So the problem, too, is that in 1937, they both had the same type blood, group A. But in 1937, they couldn't distinguish between what was his group A and what was her group A.
Questions? Well, with that, let's conclude. I'm sure people would like to chat with you about the book. And thanks. This is our concluding program this year. We'll be back here again in February. Thank you and good evening.
Good evening. I think you have to give a thankful. left a bit more. There. You got a pen?
Okay.
Oh,
it's good to see you.
Thank you. Excuse me. Shadden, will you get this?
Oh, you got it.
Shadden.